Ayrım 19.
Sayfa 233. For his central proposal amounts to the contention that the only rational and consistent criterion available for the guidance of action is the assessment of the pleasurable and painful consequences of any particular action, and that the meaning of evaluative expressions can only be understood in this context. There is no alternative rational criterion for at least two kinds of reason. The first is that theories, such as those based on a belief in natural law or natural rights, which suppose that there are rights, duties, and obligations apart from and prior to those embodied in positive law, are taught by Bentham to rest on a basis of logical error. For they are, on his view, the product of a belief that words like duty and obligation are names which have a sense and a reference quite independent of their use in any particular context. Bentham's own logical views on this point are a mixture of truth and error. On the one hand, he grasped correctly that only in the context of a sentence does a naming, describing, or referring expression have meaning, a point that was to be made a commonplace only by Frege and Wittgenstein. On the other hand, it is in no way clear that adherence of natural law and natural rights theories are necessarily committed to the logical error of supposing otherwise. A more serious criticism of such theories is intimately connected with one of Bentham's most important motives in attacking them. Suppose that anyone asserts that men possess natural rights or are bound by natural laws. It is notorious that adherents of such theories offer lists which differ in substance from each other. Is there, then, any criterion for the correct inclusion of an item on such a test? Bentham's conviction that there is not was directed in the first instance at the reactionary sanctification of the legal and penal status quo that Blackstone, in his commentaries on the law of England, accomplished by the use of the theory of natural law. But Bentham was completely impartial in the application of his skeptical doubts, and in spite of his sympathy for the American Revolution and for at least the initial phases of the French Revolution, he is trenchant in his criticism of the revolutionary doctrine of the rights of man, a doctrine which he declares to be nonsense, and in his criticism of the doctrine of imprescriptible natural rights, nonsense on stilts. If, then, a first reason for holding that only the principle of utility, the principle of the greatest happiness of the greatest number, furnishes us with a criterion for action is the elite logical impossibility of any metaphysical theory of morals, a second is the foundation laid for the principle in human psychology. Men are made so that they are placed under the dominion of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. Bentham's psychology, whose source is in Hartley, is mechanical and associationist. We cannot but pursue pleasure and flee pain, and the association of the prospect of either with something else will draw us to or repel us from whatever pleasure or pain is associated with. Bentham takes it for granted that pleasure and pain are correlative terms and that both are equally simple and unitary concepts. He gives 58 synonyms for pleasure, and his logical sophistication about naming on other occasions does not prevent him from behaving as if happiness, enjoyment, and pleasure all name or characterize the same sensation. Different sources of pleasure can be measured and compared in respect of the intensity and duration of the sensation derived from them, the certainty or otherwise of having the sensation, and the propinquity or remoteness of the pleasure. In choosing between alternatives, quantity of pleasure is the only criterion. Quantity of pleasure being equal, Pushpin is as good as poetry. Footnote: Works edited by Bowring, 253. Moreover, in summing up the pleasures of a number of people, everybody is to count for one and nobody as more than one. If each individual is in fact moved by the prospects of his own pleasure or pain, what becomes of altruism? Bentham's thought is not entirely coherent here. On the one hand, in his political and legislative proposals, he recognizes the conflict between public and private interest and the need for molding human nature. His wish to construct a society in which a man's pursuit of his private pleasure and his pursuit of the greatest happiness of the greatest number will coincide clearly rests on the assumption that society is not at present so organized. But elsewhere, and especially in the Deontology, Bentham implicitly identifies the greatest happiness of the individual with that to be found in the pursuit of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. The only motive for obeying the rules necessary to social life is the pleasure to be found in obedience or the pain resulting from disobeying them. There is no problem which Benthamite utilitarianism raises which was not raised within the utilitarian tradition itself, and the burden of these problems fell upon John Stuart Mill. His father, James Mill, was an enthusiastic collaborator of Bentham's, himself a psychologist in the tradition of Hartley, who once wrote that he aspired to make the human mind as plain as the road from St. Paul's to Charing Cross. This spirit of self-confidence was scarcely inherited by his son. In late adolescence, after an education which had laid adult burdens upon him from the earliest possible age, he turned from his absorption in schemes of social reform to inquire whether, if all such projects were to be accomplished, this would render him happy. The sinking heart with which he answered, no, presaged a nervous breakdown from which he was rescued to an important extent by the poetry of Wordsworth and Coleridge. But it was to be significant for more than Mill's personal life that the coincidence between private happiness and that of the greatest number should have failed the utilitarians themselves so early. Mill's whole tenor of thought is that of a utilitarian who cannot avoid any of the difficulties which this doctrine raises, but who cannot conceive of abandoning his doctrine either. What are the difficulties? First, Mill abandons the view that the comparison between pleasures is or can be purely quantitative. He introduces a qualitative distinction between higher and lower pleasures. The higher pleasures are to be preferred. Better Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. How can we be sure of this? Only he who has experienced both is qualified to judge, and only the wise man who prefers the Socratic classification has this experience. Yet here doubt necessarily arises. How could a Mill know what it was like to be a satisfied fool, any more than the fool could not know what it was like to be Mill? The point of this question extends further than to cast doubt upon a single contention of Mill's. For what it brings out is that Mill is still engaged, as Bentham was, in trying to bring all the objects and goals of human desire under a single concept, that of pleasure, and trying to show them as all commensurable with each other in a single scale of evaluation. Moreover, he, like Bentham, treats pleasure as a unitary concept. He is able to do so because the concept of pleasure has tended to degenerate, just as the concept of duty has. I have already suggested that, in the case of duty, a highly specific concept associated with the notion of the duties of an office holder evaporates into a generalized notion of what a man ought to do. So pleasure as the concept of one specific kind of goal is transformed into the concept of any goal at all. Both hedonists and Puritans contribute to the history of this degeneration. Hedonists, who begin by commending pleasure against other goals, then become defensive and insist that they are not merely commending wine, women, and song, but also the higher pleasures, such as reading the Critique of Pure Reason. Puritans insist that they are not against pleasure as such, but only low or false pleasures. They, too, are for true and lasting pleasures, such as only Zion's children know. So concepts like pleasure and happiness are stretched and extended in all directions until they are used simply to name whatever men aim at. By this extension, they become useless for evaluative and moral purposes. For in evaluation, and especially in moral evaluation, we are not only engaged in grading and in choosing between alternative objects, which we already desire, we are also engaged in grading and choosing between the cultivation of alternative dispositions and desires. The injunction, pursue happiness, when happiness has been given the broad, undifferentiated sense which Bentham and Mill give to it, is merely the injunction, try to achieve what you desire. But as to any question about rival objects of desire or about alternative and competing desires, this injunction is silent and empty. And this is equally true whether the happiness which I am to cultivate is to be my own or that of the greatest number. Mill, faced with the objection that there are many cases in which one cannot assess which out of the alternative possible courses of action will produce the greatest happiness of the greatest number, asserts that utilitarianism enjoins no more than that in cases where one can so assess the consequences of action, one ought to use the principle of utility as a criterion. But this concession is more deadly than he perceives, for he is forced to allow implicitly that there are other evaluative criteria. What they are and what their relationship to the principle of utility may be, he never makes clear. But we may accept Mill's concession in the spirit in which it is offered if we recognize that when utilitarians speak of the greatest happiness, they are often in practice speaking of a quite specific goal for action rather than of the generalized concept of their theoretical appetites. This goal is that of the public welfare, and it is a goal peculiarly relevant to those areas of life in which Bentham was especially interested. Prisons and hospitals, penal codes and constitutional processes, in these areas it is possible to ask and to answer adequately, even if only crudely, the question of how many people's lot will be bettered, how many people's lot will be worsened by such and such a measure. For we have obvious and established criteria for faring well or ill in these areas. Will ill health be increased or diminished? Will the attaching of this rather than that penalty to this crime diminish or increase the frequency of its occurrence? Even in these cases, there are choices to be made on which no version of the principle of utility can guide us. An example is the choice between devoting resources to health services or devoting them to penal reform. But it is necessary to emphasize that the utilitarian advocacy of the criterion of public happiness is not only a mistake. That it seems so obviously the criterion to be considered in certain areas of life is something we owe to Bentham and Mill. The concept of happiness is, however, morally dangerous in another way, for we are by now well aware of the malleability of human beings, of the fact that they can be conditioned in a variety of ways into the acceptance of and satisfaction with almost anything. That men are happy with their lot never entails that their lot is what it ought to be. For the question can always be raised of how great the price is that is being paid for the happiness. So the concept of the greatest happiness, of the greatest number, could be used to defend any paternalistic or totalitarian society in which the price paid for happiness is the freedom of the individuals in that society to make their own choices. Freedom and happiness can in certain circumstances be radically incompatible values. We can trace one legitimate offspring of utilitarianism for whom freedom was sacrificed to happiness in the history of Fabian socialism. For Fabianism, socialism was a matter of schemes of reform initiated from above by the enlightened few for the welfare of the unenlightened many. Fabianism stands at the opposite pole in the history of socialism from the revolutionary democracy of Rosa Luxemburg or the IWW, for whom socialism consisted in workers becoming free from the domination of others and owners and directors of their work and their lives. Moreover, the concept of the greatest happiness of the greatest number is only applicable with any kind of moral legitimacy in a society in which it is assumed that non-utilitarian norms of decent behavior are upheld. The concept of the public happiness has obviously legitimate application in a society where the consensus is that the public happiness consists in more and better hospitals and schools. But what application has it in a society where the public happiness is found by the public itself to consist in the mass murder of Jews? If in a society of 12 people, 10 are sadists who will get great pleasure from torturing the remaining two, does the principle of utility enjoin that the two should be tortured? Nothing could have been further from the thought of Bentham and Mill, but this only makes it clearer that they are not consistent utilitarians, that they rely on an implicit appeal to other norms, which they covertly use to define the greatest happiness. It is this sieve-like nature of the utilitarian concept of pleasure or happiness which makes Mill's proof of the principle of utility so unimpressive. Mill's proof runs as follows. He begins by allowing that, in any strict sense, proof on matters concerning ultimate ends is not to be obtained. But nonetheless, we may adduce considerations capable of influencing the intellect. The argument then proceeds from the assertion that, just as the only way to show that something is visible is to show that man can see it, so the only way to show that something is desirable is to show that man desire it. But all men desire pleasure, so pleasure is universally desirable. Mill has no problem about the transition from the desire for my own pleasure to that for the greatest happiness of the greatest number, which he makes by means of the bold assertion that the pleasure of another is naturally pleasurable to me. When Mill comes to show that only pleasure is desired, his method is to take apparent alternative goals and show that originally they are desired for the pleasure which accompanies them, and only secondarily do they become desired for their own sake. This method of argument is of course necessarily ineffective. If anything, it shows that there are goals other than pleasure. But criticism of Mill has centered on that part of his argument where he passes from the assertion that pleasure is desired to the assertion that it is desirable. What Mill's critics, beginning with G. E. Moore, have in effect said is that Mill illegitimately tries to deduce the conclusion that pleasure ought to be desired from the premise that it is in fact desired. But this, so it is alleged, is necessarily a fallacious inference. For an is cannot by itself entail an ought. One does not have to enter on any general discussion of fact and value to deal with such critics. They are of course right that the inference in question is fallacious if it is intended as an entailment, but they are simply mistaken in their reading of Mill. For what Mill says about proof makes it clear that he does not intend to use the assertion that all men do, in fact, desire pleasure as a premise which entails the conclusion that they ought to desire it. What the form of his argument is not perhaps entirely clear, but one way of reading him, more consonant with the text of utilitarianism, would be this. He treats the thesis that all men desire pleasure as a factual assertion which guarantees the success of an ad hominem appeal to anyone who denies his conclusion. If anyone denies that pleasure is desirable, then we can ask him, "But don't you desire it?" And we know in advance that he must answer yes, and consequently must admit that pleasure is desirable. But this reading of Mill, and indeed any reading, has to interpret him as treating the assertion that all men desire pleasure as a contingent factual assertion. Now it can only be such if pleasure is being treated as the name of one possible object of desire among others, for it is simply an expression equivalent to whatever men desire. Then the assertion is a vacuous tautology and will not serve Mill's argumentative purposes. Yet if pleasure is the name of one specific object of desire, the wine, women, and song sense, as it often is, then it is certainly false that all men desire it, Puritans do not, or that it is the only desired goal. It is thus on the haziness of his central concept that Mill founders, and not on the transition from is to ought. In the course of the previous discussion, another difficulty has come into view. Clearly, even on the best and most charitable interpretation of the concept of the greatest happiness of the greatest number, there are occasions where its use as a criterion would lead us to recommend courses of action which conflict sharply with what ordinarily we think we ought to do. A typical case was propounded by a later critic of utilitarianism, E. F. Carrot. The hanging of an innocent man may well redound to the public happiness if certain conditions are satisfied. That he is publicly believed, although not by us, his would-be executioners to be guilty of murder, let us say, and that his execution will act as a deterrent, preventing the deaths of sundry innocent people in the future. Surely, on a utilitarian view, we ought therefore to hang him. There are two possible types of utilitarian response to this criticism. The first is simply to deny that there is anything abhorrent in the situation. Certainly, a tough-minded utilitarian might say that this is the sort of thing that we ought sometimes to do. There is nothing philosophically criticizable in this response when it is taken in isolation from the rest of the case against utilitarianism. But when this response is combined with the Protean utilitarian concept of pleasure, one understands its danger. For by allowing the principle of utility to override our existing principles, such as that a man ought not to be hanged for a crime which he has not committed, we remove one more barrier to using the concept of the general happiness to license any enormity. That it can be so used has been amply demonstrated in this century. In particular, the high-minded are apt to use totalitarianism as a justification to excuse their responsibility for involvement in the large-scale crimes of their societies, such as Auschwitz or Hiroshima. But it may be objected, this is surely a moral and not a philosophical objection to utilitarianism. To which the reply is plain. Utilitarianism, which appears under the pretext of offering a criterion, among other things, for distinguishing good and evil, is in fact offering us a revision of those concepts, such that if we accepted it, we could allow that no action, however vile, was evil in itself or prohibited as such. For all actions are to be assessed in terms of their consequences, and if the consequences of an action are going to be productive of the general happiness, then that action, whether it is the execution of the innocent or the murder or rape of children, would be justified. Thus, utilitarianism is a revisionary analysis of our attitudes and concepts, and it is relevant to ask whether it would preserve what we value in those attitudes and concepts. A second type of response, that of Mill himself, is to argue that utilitarianism, rightly understood, does not license actions which we would originally abhor. So Mill argues that only the maintenance of an impartial system of justice, in which innocent and guilty receive their deserts, could serve the general happiness. And more generally, he argues that to allow exceptions to generally beneficial rules is to weaken their authority, and so is always to have harmful consequences. Later utilitarians have also argued that the principle of utility is not in all cases a criterion for judging of particular actions. Rather, it is often a criterion for judging of principles. This contention has been argued in its most sophisticated form in terms of a distinction between two logically distinct types of rule. Summary rules, which are logically subsequent to the actions which they prescribe or prohibit, and rules of practice which define classes of action and are logically prior to the actions in question. An example of the first type of rule would be one forbidding walking on the grass. The actions, walking or not walking on the grass, are logically prior to any rule about so walking. An example of the second type of rule would be that which specifies the ways in which a batsman may be out at cricket. The concept of being out and the associated actions are specifiable only in terms of the rules defining the practices which constitute the game of cricket. The first type of rule may be represented as a summary or generalization about what is enjoined or prohibited in terms of some general criterion on many particular occasions. The second type of rule cannot be so understood. Its application on particular occasions must, logically must, be subsequent to its general formulation. It has been argued that if we apply this distinction to the problem posed for utilitarianism, we see that it is only in the case of the former type of rule that the problem can arise. But then, in this case, it is easily soluble. If on many particular occasions we find that doing or refraining from doing some particular action is productive of the greatest happiness, then we may summarize our discovery in a general rule prescribing or prohibiting that action. If subsequently we find a case where to do what the rule enjoins would not be productive of the greatest happiness, then we need have no hesitation about abandoning the rule for this occasion, because the rule has no force or authority except that which derives from the greatest happiness principle. But this only applies for the first type of rule. The second type of rule constitutes or partly constitutes a practice which as a whole and in the long run may be justified by appeal to the greatest happiness principle. But one cannot ask for a particular rule to be set aside because on a particular occasion its application violates that principle. For the rule is adhered to because of its connection with the practice, not because directly and in itself it promotes the greatest happiness principle. Thus, it is logically inappropriate to ask whether a particular rule in a game should be waived on a particular occasion because its application violates the greatest happiness principle. And it is logically inappropriate to ask for the waiving of a particular rule of justice on a particular occasion because the application of that rule violates the greatest happiness principle. It is a whole system of justice which stands or falls at the bar of the principle of utility and not the detail of particular cases. So the hanging of the innocent man on a particular occasion to secure a particular deterrent is not sanctioned by a utilitarian justification of justice after all. It is the whole practice of justice with its systematic protection of innocence and nothing less than that which receives a utilitarian justification. Will this defense suffice? Does it succeed in showing that utilitarianism is compatible with our ordinary belief in justice? What it ignores is the fact that we often do waive and regard ourselves as justified in waiving principles of justice in the interests of human happiness. So someone may fail to report a crime or fail to punish a criminal because of the effects on his family. The fact that justice is a systematic body of practices justifiable as a whole in utilitarian terms is not incompatible with there being clashes between particular applications of the principles of justice and the application of the greatest happiness principle. We then have to decide what weight to give to the principles of justice, and we should not have to make such a decision if it were entirely a matter of applying a single ultimate principle. The value we set upon justice is not, therefore, entirely derived from our adherence to the principle of utility. Thus, the attempt to shore up utilitarianism in this way is itself a misconceived attempt to give a false unity to our values. That such an attempt should be made is easily understood. The individualism of modern society and the increasingly rapid and disruptive rate of social change brings about a situation in which, for increasing numbers, there is no overall shape to the moral life, but only a set of apparently arbitrary principles inherited from a variety of sources. In such circumstances, the need for a public criterion for use in settling moral and evaluative disagreements and conflicts becomes ever more urgent and ever more difficult to meet. The utilitarian criterion, which appears to embody the liberal ideal of happiness, is apparently without rivals, and the fact that the concept of happiness, which it embodies, is so amorphous and so adaptable, makes it not less but more welcome to those who look for a court of appeal on evaluative questions which they can be assured will decide in their own favor. No philosopher expressed the moral situation of 19th century England, and to some extent we are all still in the 19th century better than Henry Sidgwick. Sidgwick is a touching figure whose defects are usually the defects of his age. He was preoccupied with the loss of his own Christian faith in a way that is foreign to us. His moral psychology is crude because the psychology of his time was crude. And in his moral philosophy, he mirrors his age also. For Sidgwick, the history of moral philosophy in the preceding century had centered on the clash between utilitarianism and what he called intuitionism. By this he meant the doctrine that the moral first principles are intuitively known, the doctrine of Price and earlier of Locke. Within utilitarianism, further, there is the argument about the relationship between the pursuit of my own happiness and the pursuit of the greatest happiness of the greatest number. Sidgwick painstakingly examined all the possible waves of assimilating intuitionism to utilitarianism, or of bridging the gap between the goals of private and public happiness. But in the end, there remain three distinct sources of morality. Sidgwick's account of the methods of ethics misses questions beyond those which he explicitly discusses. The background to his account is the moral consciousness of his day, taken as given. Philosophy appears as essentially a clarifying rather than a critical activity. In this respect, Sidgwick's is a ghost that haunts much recent writing. In his acceptance of the utilitarian consciousness of his own age, he contrasts sharply with his contemporaries T.H. Green and F.H. Bradley. Green and Bradley are often classed together as Oxford idealists. It is important, however, to remember that the classing of them together in this way is the work of their later critics. They themselves worked independently, and the similarities in their writings are the result of the similarity of their self-set tasks. Both were keen students of Kant and Hegel, both wish to find materials in Kant and Hegel with which to carry through a criticism of Hume and Mill. Both draw on Greek philosophy as well as on German, but Green was perhaps influenced by Rousseau as much as by any other author, while there is little trace of Rousseau in Bradley, and Green's philosophical preoccupations were intimately related to his commitments to social and educational reform, whereas Bradley was a philosophical recluse. Both Green and Bradley break with the individualism of utilitarianism. The utilitarian picture of society is of a collection of individuals, each with his own determinate desires and his consequent goals. The shared aims and norms of society are a product of the compromises and agreements of individuals. The public good is a sum total of private goods. Both Green and Bradley break with this picture, whether in its utilitarian or its social contract forms. Both recognize that the individual discovers his aims and his desires from within a set of rule-governed relationships to others. He finds himself through, he identifies himself by means of, a set of relationships through which goals are partly specified for him. The individual then has his choices to make. He can appraise his own desires in a variety of ways, but his nature, including his desires, is not pre-social. If this argument were pursued, it would have to press the question of the relationship of morality to the social framework more seriously and in detail. Both Green and Bradley, however, place the individual not merely in a social but in a metaphysical context, or rather they appear to perform social analysis in a highly metaphysical style. To make clear what this means, it is necessary to follow through the key themes of each in turn. Bradley, for example, poses the question, "Why should I be moral?" a question which he uses as the title of one of his ethical studies, only to reply that, as it stands, the question is improper. For it suggests that there is an end beyond morality, to which the exercise of moral virtue is only a means. But from within the moral consciousness, we can discern that morality does have an end, an end not beyond morality, but constituted by morality itself in its highest achievement, the realization of the self as a whole. I realize myself as a whole through actions which express the stirring of the self to be something better and higher than it is already, so that the principles to which I aspire to conform come to be the principles expressed in my actual behavior. In any situation of choice between alternatives, I realize myself first in so far as I am aware of myself independently of the two alternatives and confronting them, and second in self-consciously choosing one alternative and identifying myself with it, whereby I bring the whole self into being in concrete form. This Bradley calls the concrete universal, the judgment of universal import made concrete in the realized activity of the concrete individual. The self develops to the point at which it realizes itself completely by identifying itself as a part in an infinite whole, and so transcending its own finite bounds. The difficulty is being limited, and so not a whole. How to extend myself so as to be a whole? The answer is, be a member in a whole. Here your private self, your finitude, ceases as such to exist. It becomes the function of an organism. You must be not a mere piece of, but a member in, a whole. and as this, must know and will yourself. What is the whole in which the individual self must realize itself? We get not a completely coherent answer to this question, but at least part of an answer in a later chapter of Ethical Studies, My Station and Its Duties. Bradley had already, in previous essays, attacked the view that the end which the moral consciousness places before us can be either pleasure or duty for its own sake. His grounds for breaking with Benthamite utilitarianism and with Kantianism are partly different and partly the same. He argues, for example, that pleasure supervenes upon a desired end and so cannot be the end. And he argues that on the Kantian view, duty is proposed as an end for a self, which is constituted by desires and inclinations, such that duty can have no interest for it, cannot be an end for it. But in both cases, he argues that the end proposed is too general and abstract. The formulas of Kant and Bentham alike try to bring the multifarious ends which men in different circumstances and at different times pursue under a single characterization, and in so doing they present a formula which is in effect contentless. Because it includes anything which a man might pursue, it identifies nothing which he must pursue, if he is to be true to the deliverances of his moral consciousness.